Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations for 2022, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Atiano Othiambo, director of the Legal Empowerment Fund, a program of the Fund for Global Human Rights. A lawyer by training, Atiano's experience ranges from working for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Kenya to representing marginalized people in Washington State and Kenya. She's currently based in Nairobi, Kenya, so thank you so much for joining us at The Conduit today, Atiano. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you grew up in Kenya, and you were forced to immigrate to the US just as you were embarking on a law degree. Tell me a little bit about your journey and how you ended up in the social justice world.
I believe my social justice has always been part and parcel of my growing up in my family. My father was a university professor in Nairobi just when Kenya was a really repressive state. And we were always hearing whispers about repression. There were political detainees. There were disappearances going on. And my father was a critic of the government. And at that time, gatherings were disallowed. So one of the things I always do remember as a little child was having visitors come into the house, knowing that this big gathering was not supposed to be happening, and having a little bit of the palpable fear that if we were found out, something would happen. So lots of times there were conversations around human rights, around sedition, around treason, things that they were doing, which were really just normal, run-of-the-mill, but were considered treasonous. My father ended up being detained without trial while we lived in Kenya, and upon his release, found a way to make it to the United States and resettled there. And we as family members then subsequently moved and joined him. I was very surprised when I moved to the U.S., to find that there was injustice there, that the populations were marginalized, because the impression you get living in the global South is that it's this land of milk and honey, that everything is fine. And I remember when my dad picked us up from the airport and there were people, sleeping under bridges. And I asked him, is this really possible in this country? And his response was, this is an interesting society and it's not any different than the society we have left. In Kenya, injustice exists both in Kenya and in the United States, and exists everywhere. I think the interesting thing for me then was to think about, this is a country that can send a man to the moon, but still hasn't figured out how to provide justice to everybody. So in that sense, living in the U.S., being a woman of color, being an immigrant, and facing the day-to-day challenges that people of color, immigrants, women face, was really what brought me to and clinched my interest in social justice. So right when I graduated from, I went to undergraduate in Texas, went to law school in New Orleans, and when I graduated, I knew this was the area that I wanted to be in. I do recall taking a class on social change in as an undergraduate, and one of the things that struck me was the history of the Native American people in the United States. And that was not something I was exposed to. This was the first time I was reading about a genocide that happened, towards a population. And that really, again, struck me as very odd and very strange, that this is a great country, yet you had a history of, a genocide of Native American populations, a history of slavery. And then to see that even after independence, even as the United States was growing to be this great democracy, there were structural policy issues that prevented people, marginalized populations, from achieving justice.
So I want to ask you a little bit about that experience in the U.S. How do you account for that experience, that contradiction at the heart of the American experience? One of the world's great democracies, but also a place that has so much unresolved legacies, so much structural injustice. Because I suspect that will also contain some of the germs of the work that you're now doing. But what was that experience like for you as coming from Kenya to see this persistent injustice in the U.S.?
I think one of the experiences I had, and this is something I say all the time, is that I never knew I was a black person until I went to the United States, and that my color was really what determined how people treated me, determined access I had to, you know, services. It really determined my life. And I walked around now, you know, I used to be just Atieno when I lived in Kenya. And now I was Atieno, labeled as Atieno, a black person, Atieno, an immigrant. I think there are just quite a number of structural and institutional mechanisms that are in place in the United States. Do I think they are deliberate? I think yes. I think they are deliberately to perpetuate this system that exists there. But I also know that there are lots of activists and people who are trying to dismantle that. But I would say that the root cause of systemic injustice in the United States is racism. And that's, you know, one big policy, that's one big way that the U.S. has not been able to unpack it. It's an interesting thing because when we moved to the United States, my father would say, this is a very great country, interesting country, but the issue of race is something that is so ingrained and it's so difficult to unpack and so difficult to understand. And, you know, here he was an, you know, university professor and still grappling with, what does this mean? And how does a system continue to perpetuate this, yet it's a great democracy? So I don't think I have the answer to that. I'm still grappling with it. I'm still trying to understand it. And, you know, it's great to have movements like the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, what's been happening in the U.S. now, which is really bringing this conversation to the fore. It was always something that was hidden. And, you know, for myself as an immigrant, one of the interesting things was that a lot of people would say to me, well, you're not really black, you're different. But when I would walk out the door, I wasn't different. You know, I was, you know, this black person. So I do feel that, you know, there is the dialogue is starting. It's been there, but now it's really coming to the forefront. Not just, you know, issues of race, but also gender. And, you know, when you look at black, indigenous, and people of color in general in the United States, those, you know, the dialogue is starting to happen. It's becoming almost mainstream to talk about it. So that, to me, gives me a lot of hope.
So now let's talk about your work in Kenya. So you found your way back to Kenya, and you had experience working for the Kenyan Supreme Court, and you became particularly passionate about closing what you've termed, or others have termed, the global justice gap. And so can you tell us a little bit more of what that actually means? What is the justice gap, and how does your organization or your work seek to narrow or close that gap?
Well, the justice gap is the difference between the justice that people want and need and the justice that they get. When I moved back to Kenya, one thing that really struck me was I moved at a time when there was a new constitution. There was a new chief justice. There was so much hope. And this was a constitution that came by through a referendum. And a lot of us who were in the diaspora went back to Kenya because we felt that this is a time for us to make a change, especially those of us who had left not on our own volition. And to go to Kenya and to live there and to really have peg a lot of hope on this constitution, I came out disappointed because it seemed that it was really more about the words in the constitution, but the government was not willing to enact and to give people what the constitution mandated. With regard to the justice gap, it became very clear that, you know, the justice that people want and need was not what they were getting. And, you know, when we reference the global justice gap, it really is talking about the 5.1 billion people, which is about two-thirds of the world's population that do not have access to justice. And this lack of access to justice is what makes them even more marginalized. So, for example, you have over 200 million stateless people, you know, in the world today. And if you're stateless and you live in areas of conflict, you are not able to get legal documentation. Without legal documentation, you can't get an ID. Without an ID, you can't access education. You can't access You can't access healthcare, so you continue to be marginalized. So when we talk about this justice gap, it's really about how do we close it? And yes, you know, a lot of work has been done towards strengthening justice institutions to make sure that there is access to justice. For example, in Kenya, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court made it a point to say that of the 47 counties in Kenya, he was going to make sure that each of those counties had a high court so that the justice was close to the people. So I think there is, you know, that's one of the ways of trying to close that justice gap, but that's not enough.
So this is clearly what led you to establish the Legal Empowerment Fund, and that was launched in September of last year, 2021. Can you explain to us what the Legal Empowerment Fund does, what's its aim, and how you see it creating impact?
So legal empowerment, you know, when we simply put, is about putting the power of the law in the hands of people. I always believe that people are the dictators of their own liberation. So as I've mentioned previously, a lot of time and money has been spent in strengthening justice institutions. However, large swaths of the populations do not use a formal justice system to resolve their disputes. And, you know, a study was done in Kenya where they showed that 85% of all disputes are settled informally, not within the courts, because it's expensive to hire a lawyer. Even though you build a court in every county, there's no guarantee that that people have access to get to those courts. So what legal empowerment really about is about teaching people to know the law, to use the law, and to shape the law. Because once they have, and I usually refer to that as the revolution. The revolution is coming. As once people know the power that they have in the law, they are then able to agitate for their own rights. And these rights, you know, there's always that conversation about empowerment. And I've always had a problem with the word empowerment because it means that you're disempowered. But to me, legal empowerment is about giving people back the power they already had that structures and institutions took away from them. So the Legal Empowerment Fund, our goal is to provide resources to grassroots organizations and grassroots communities to help them agitate for their own rights. Communities are best placed to provide solutions to their problems. And as a legal aid lawyer, you know, we'd walk into a community, see what was going on, say there's injustice happening here, we can resolve it this way through this legal system. You file a case, win a great victory, and then you have this wonderful victory on paper. But what did that mean to the local communities that, you know, we had fought on behalf of? Most of them had no idea that there was a legal victory. And, you know, another phrase we always used to say is a court order is as good as toilet paper because it doesn't mean anything. And until communities are educated and do know that this particular policy, this particular legislation actually works, to my benefit, it's really useless. So legal empowerment is about letting them know, having communities know and push for their rights based on what is already on the books, and also to push for their rights based on, you know, universal human rights that exist. I think it's very difficult for communities to understand what their legal rights are if it's also not translated into a language in which they do understand. And an example I always give is the dialogue that's going on with, you know, vis-a-vis climate change and climate justice. And during COP26, a good friend and neighbor of mine who works for a large organization was going to Glasgow. And I said to her, you know, explain to me what's at stake at COP26. And she's directed me to read some literature. And by the time I'd read it maybe three or four times, I'm like, I don't understand this. And I said, I need a PhD to understand this. So if we are talking about, for example, climate justice, but it's been spoken about on such a high level, yet the stewards of the natural resources that we want to maintain and preserve are local and indigenous communities. If they don't understand that language, how do we then expect to have this great movement of, you know, for climate justice and climate change? So one of the things I'm hoping to do with the Legal Empowerment Fund is to make sure that we de-silo those conversations and make sure that communities that, you know, who are, who really should have a seat at the table during these negotiations, who do know, you know, how to preserve these resources, I do hope that, you know, they would be able to have that, have the same audience as the policymakers, because really, at the end of the day, they've been preserving these resources for hundreds of years, and they do know how to do it.
So let me ask you what may sound like a kind of chicken and egg question, which is, communities need the resources to be able to fight for their rights, but they also need to know that they have those rights in the first place. So in some ways, before you can even get to, you know, litigating or having your day in court or asserting your rights, you need a prior education process to give people a sense of agency and a sense of what they're entitled to. So how do you balance out what I should imagine is a difficult question about the allocation of scarce resources between telling people and showing people they have rights versus helping them act upon, realize, and litigate around those rights once the first precondition has been met?
That's an interesting question. I think when I look at legal empowerment, I look at it in the vis-a-vis the structure that, you know, global health and how global health has been funded. For a long time, health was funded from a very top-down perspective. So then when, you know, up came the AIDS pandemic in places like Africa, where, and especially within in Kenya, in the region where I come from, where my ethnic group is from, there were lots of deaths occurring there. But you could strengthen the structures in the hospitals. You could, you know, have doctors. You could have the ARVs there. But what you really needed was community workers to go out into villages, to go out and talk to people about what was necessary for them in order to stem the tide with regard to the AIDS pandemic. I think, again, when you give resources to at the grassroots level and you put in the resources there, then with legal empowerment, you don't really have to litigate. It's really about the negotiation. So if you put the resources towards, for example, paralegals or, you know, community workers who are on the ground, who are living within these communities, then they are able to go forth and tell people about their rights. And it's not as expensive as putting up a courthouse or litigating a case, because, again, a lot of these issues are resolved outside of that. So in terms of where to put the resources, I think, you know, a lot has been spent and should continue to be spent on strengthening justice systems. But at the same time, grassroots communities, grassroots organizations need to get equal resources. And I think the health area has been a very good example of how, when you get communities involved, then you're able to solve issues.
Another related question for you. When you're trying to decide about who to fund and support, these must be some of the most agonizing decisions, because there's infinite need, incredible worthy cases, and you have limited resources. Do you find yourself doing a triage between this case, the prospects of winning this case or this fight are high with a little bit of resource, versus the odds are really stacked against this group, but we really should give them a shot, even if they land up losing, and we may arguably have squandered our resources, but the act of losing lays down a trail or an infrastructure of activism which may allow people to come back another day?
That's a tough one. The Legal Empowerment Fund recently launched a call for proposals, a global open call for proposals, and we launched this on January 18th. And the goal was to send it, disseminate that call as far and wide as possible. And I think in my naive world, I thought, oh, we'll just get maybe 300 applicants. We've gotten over 1,000 and have to do a review. And this is really because the attraction for this was because everybody's looking for core funding and general support funding, which is unrestricted, which is what the Legal Empowerment Fund is. You know, this first call is really about unrestricted general funding, because we don't want to go in and dictate this group or this group or this community have to do a project based on what we think is viable. But, you know, we are saying you are the dictators of your, you are the writers of your, of your destiny, of your liberation. So we, you know how to use these resources. In terms of how are we going to make the determination, I think we are, we're looking to make sure that we have a regional diversity. So the call for proposals went out in French, Portuguese, Arabic, Spanish, and English. Of course, there's always the question of, why does it have to be in all, mostly in colonial languages, but we are getting there, slow but sure. Hopefully one day we'll have it in, other dialects. And we want the call to be global. I mean, we want diversity of geographic diversity, thematic diversity. So we will have a grants panel. I'm not going to be making the decision, thank God. We'll have a panel of grassroots activists and academics who are going to make a determination as to who gets funded. I think, it's one thing to figure out and say, well, this case or this particular issue has a lot more viability. Victory is going to be much greater. But the thing about the law and the thing about going through a system like this is that it's small baby steps. When I look at, for example, gay marriage in the U.S., it was small baby steps. And then it comes to this culmination of finally, a gay couple can get married. But then you slowly lay that foundation. And I think when it comes to, which groups we are going to fund, it really is going to be, based on what it is they're trying to do. And, I can't purport to know, this is going to, whether something is going to work in the DRC or whether it's going to work in Venezuela. But again, it's really, what is compelling? What are the innovative ideas people are coming up with to seek justice? And, not just, one run of the mill, one by one, case by case, on a case by case basis, but looking at it more, more holistically, but also looking to fund ecosystems. You can't just say, I'm going to fund an organization that's doing strategic litigation. The question is, what else is going on there? So when you look at families of the disappeared, whether it's in Guatemala or in Mexico, funding those families to seek justice in court is one thing, but what about their psychological well-being? What about, the environment in which we are living? What about the policies that have allowed this to happen? So, for the Legal Empowerment Fund, it's really about also funding an ecosystem, not just one particular area of injustice.
I find that fascinating. So you could find yourself funding an organization that is working to discover the fate and whereabouts of the disappeared, to pursue justice and accountability for those people responsible, but also an organization that either itself or alongside those efforts provide trauma counseling or mental health support to the family members who are left behind in the wake of a disappearance. And you could support all of those different efforts.
Absolutely. And that is the beauty of the organization that the Legal Empowerment Fund is part of. The Fund for Global Human Rights is an organization that has been in existence for over 20 years and has given over $100 million, to organizations and groups in over 25 countries. And what they do is they do fund ecosystems, not just one particular organization. So I think when you fund an ecosystem, you are now starting to get down and deeper into the root cause of the injustices you're seeking to help remedy.
I presume from what you've said, you don't just work on cases in the global south. You also work in persistent injustices in the north. So can I confirm that that is the case?
Yes, that is the case. And the interesting thing about the call for proposals that we put out is a lot of questions came back from the global north, from Europe, from the Caribbean, saying, do we qualify for funding? And I think the presumption is always that injustice happens in the global south. And, true to form, a lot of applications are coming from the global south and a lot from Anglophone Africa. And so we are asking ourselves, why are we not getting a lot of applications from Francophone or Lusophone Africa? Why are we not getting a lot of applications from, Spanish-speaking countries? And I think, my lay conclusion is that the definition of legal empowerment and what we think of as legal empowerment could be very translatable in, you know, common law countries, but not very translatable in other jurisdictions. I think when people hear legal empowerment, they think the law. So there are lots of organizations and communities that are doing legal empowerment work but don't self-identify as doing legal empowerment work. And I was one of those. When I was working in legal aid or working with communities, I didn't know that what I was doing was legal empowerment work. I just thought, you know, I'm just helping agitate for rights. So I think one of the things we have to do is make sure that we are that we are putting the word out that legal empowerment is not just only, you know, about the law and, you know, using the law only, but, you know, there are people who could be using it but are, you know, don't self-identify.
How do you think about the boundaries between, I mean, law is inescapably political in some ways.
Yes.
And so you can choose cases that are a little more able to generate popular support. So clean air litigation, you know, a mother whose daughter is asthmatic and dies as a result of dirty air disproportionately affecting both poor people and people of color. Even though dirty air is invisible, this is a case that a lot of people can get behind. It intuitively feels like the right kind of case. Then you have unpopular people, I say that in quotes, who don't enjoy public sympathy but perhaps should. People who are left behind in Syria, who are stripped of their UK citizenship without due process, who are much easier to demonize and who don't perhaps enjoy popular support or public support, but are therefore even more vulnerable and more marginalized, but are harder cases. How do you make those judgment calls?
The good thing is that with legal empowerment, it's not really I don't feel like we're making a judgment call. I think what we are doing is really saying to the world, there are all these, you know, different problems. And you are right, for example, you know, when it comes to climate, when it comes to, you know, polluted air, it is much easier to get funding and people would, you know, come forth and fund a cause, you know, around clean air. When it comes to the, you know, folks who are abandoned in Syria, it's much more difficult. Legal empowerment really to me is about not having judgment, but really looking at the injustice itself. And if there is a way to undo that injustice, if there is structures that can undo that injustice, then that is a, you know, a cause worth funding. I think, you know, one of the hard things with doing legal empowerment work or any justice work, you know, per se, is it is political. And donors don't want to be seen as giving to causes that could raise temperatures. And so there's always that interesting dialogue you have to have with a donor. I remember when I was working for an organization in Kenya, and they were looking at helping the government of Kenya set up a court that would prosecute cases that had occurred during post-election violence in Kenya in 2007 and 2008. And the organization was very adamant and was receiving US funding to help the government of Kenya set up a high court, you know, to try these particular crimes against humanity. And after about 6 months on the job, I said, this is actually not going to work. There is no political will to prosecute these cases. So why don't we look at alternative justice mechanisms, so customary informal justice mechanisms? The pushback was, absolutely not. This is very unpopular. How do we go back to the U.S. Congress and say taxpayer dollars is going towards an alternative justice or customary justice systems that are very patriarchal and are discriminatory towards women? And so, again, having the conversation and the dialogue and saying, you know, most people don't want to go through the formal justice system to seek justice. What they're really looking for is restorative justice. What they're really looking for is forgiveness and reconciliation. They don't want the neighbor who stole from them or chased them off their land. They don't want that person to go to jail. What they want is some reconciliation because they've lived together. So even those unpopular and popular mechanisms are, you know, there is room for them. But I think if properly explained, you start to see the angle, the justice angle is the same.
Do you fund organizations or cases or both?
I would say we fund communities. Yes. Not cases, communities, but also it's again if it's a community that's pursuing a case and that is really in the driver's seat about on a case, then we'll fund that community and that organization. But I would not say we fund cases.
And I know one of the things that you're trying to do is get to the root causes of systemic injustice, not just Band-Aid and treat the manifestation of that. So, and often you can have court cases that can win a victory that papers over an injustice but doesn't deal with the systemic or the structural injustice. So how do you think about your funding strategy to try and get to the latter and not the former?
I think the funding strategy is investment in communities, because those communities and putting resources to those communities really drives the systemic change, because that they are the ones who know the problem. They are the ones who even have the solutions to the problem. I mean, an example would be, you know, land tenure cases, where you'd have, you know, whether it's a woman or a family that has been whose land has been taken away. And, you know, it could be that, well, it was taken away because women are not supposed to inherit land. But when you look underneath it, you know, from a cultural perspective, well, was it that women couldn't inherit land, or has it been that because of the adoption of common law systems that women, you know, those particular women were discriminated against? So we look at bringing about systemic change or challenging systemic injustice by incorporating communities and grassroots groups into the dialogue. And with them having to help, you know, come up with the solutions, that's where I feel very strongly. I think, again, like I said before, the structural injustices, we've been dealing with them and trying to tackle them from the top down. Nobody's talking about it from the bottom up. And I think there's definitely a middle ground for both. But the investment has been overly heavily and heavily weighted towards the top-down solutions. And we are forgetting that communities and, you know, activists know the have the solutions to the problems. They're just completely underfunded.
A final question, if I may. I guess one of the dilemmas of this really amazing and creative work is how much you take a bet on a community and resource them to address and solve their own problems because they've correctly identified an injustice and are resolved to fight against it. But how much assistance, comparative policy work, legal work, expertise you lend to that community to up their chances of winning? You know, in a prior life, we would bring activists together from 10 different jurisdictions, and you could have Peruvians working with Kenyans, working with South Africans, working with Guatemalans, working with Indonesians, and sharing their experiences. And thereby, you know, they're all not directly applicable, but really having a sense that people are learning from each other. So how much of that technical assistance falls inside or outside of your mandate? Or are you really trying to kind of support relatively sophisticated organizations or communities that are already well placed to win?
I would say the technical assistance is a big part of it. And, you know, I wouldn't see it so much as a dilemma as an opportunity. I think when you look at legal empowerment is really about the intersectionality of, you know, different issues, whether it's climate, health, education, they're all intertwined. And so I see the resourcing and capacity building as bringing these groups together, as you said, you know, bring activists from different countries, help them be learning and providing regional solutions, because I feel like the world is shrinking and getting smaller and smaller. But it's also about, you know, making sure that we de-silo dialogues. So if people who are, you know, looking for, who are activists within the health sector or education sector or climate sector, they all have to be talking to each other. And I see legal empowerment as bringing these different players, these different organizations together, and particularly making sure that there is a movement building, not just within one particular area, whether it's education or health or climate, but that they're looking at it holistically. So again, when you talk about funding ecosystems, it's about making sure that there is dialogue and everybody's, you know, talking to each other, because that's how you attack and change the system from the ground up.
Parting request or question, what do you think we as individuals can do, people who are listening to this podcast can do to help close the global injustice gap? How can people get involved? What could they do if they feel moved by this really important work that you're doing?
I think getting involved in communities. I think a lot of people feel like, you know, the problem is so vast, where do I begin? You know, where do I begin with, you know, climate change? But getting involved in your community and finding out what are the problems within those communities, what's the problem within my community, and how can I help? You'll find that it could be just something as small as, you know, a river that is polluted. You know, organize and get groups together to say, you know, we as young people, we'll spend a weekend and just, you know, pull out the trash from this river. But also then start asking the questions, why is there trash in the river? And if you start asking questions about what's going on in your local community and finding those solutions, you find like-minded people. But it really is about getting proximate, getting very, you know, close to what is the cause. And I think the activism, you know, will come out of there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for this work. There are definitely echoes in Bryan Stevenson's wonderful adage and what you've just said. And I'm both an enormous fan of him and of this incredible work that you're doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Atiano and her work, please go to their website. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.